Today on Vox Talks Economics, sustaining stability amid uncertainty, the BIS Annual Economic Report 2025. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember, follow us wherever you get your podcasts, you will find us. You'll also find us on Instagram at Vox Talks Economics. It's a special episode today. The Bank for International Settlements annual economic report has just been released, and it's got a markedly less positive tone this year than last year. It warns of a deteriorating outlook for growth coupled with vulnerabilities in the global financial system. So what's the bank worried about, and how can policy and regulation respond? Frank Smets and Gaston Gelos of BIS are two of the authors who contributed to the report, and they join me now. Frank, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And Gaston as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I start with a quote from the introduction of the 2024 report that I looked up. Both professional forecasters and financial market participants see a smooth landing ahead. It is a great outcome. Should we still believe in that smooth landing and great outcome?
That's a good question. Clearly, the outlook for the global economy has darkened due to the high policy uncertainty and unpredictability since the announcement of the larger-than-expected tariffs by the U.S. administration. But until the beginning of this year, so not that long ago, the global economy seemed to be on track for this soft landing. I mean, inflation is close to central bank targets after the big inflation surge over the past years. And at the beginning of this year, most analysts expected a growth rate for the global economy around 3%, which is more or less in line with what we saw both in 23 and 24. And also labor markets were stabilizing at unemployment rates that were a little bit below actually the levels pre-pandemic. But the announcements of the larger than expected tariffs have put this soft landing in jeopardy. Financial markets responded violently in April, with stock markets plunging, credit spreads rising. Some of that financial market volatility has taken back as some of the proposed tariffs were walked back. But the uncertainty is still there, and the unpredictability of the policy, particularly in the US, is still there. And that's a drag on growth.
Yes, because as you say, most of the tariffs have been walked back or just not implemented yet. So if it is uncertainty that is causing this problem, then how does that uncertainty transmit to the global economy? Is it through investments that don't happen yet or might never happen, or is it through the financial channel?
First of all, I mean, some tariff increases have already taken place. So it's not that we don't see these effects. And of course, they're not as large as initially announced, but they're still like double or more of what the average effective tariff rate was before. So some of these effects will come through. Of course, it's still very early. And that's why when we look at the immediate impact, the uncertainty channel is definitely the more important. And we do see it has already affected consumer and business sentiment. Mm-hmm. The forecasts by analysts have been cut for this year. For the growth economy, we're talking about now 2.7%, but for some economies, particularly in North America, the US, Mexico, Canada, the reduction in the growth forecast is around 1 percentage point. So it's material. But to be frank, so far in the hard data, we haven't seen that much. But of course, hard data is lagging. And particularly in the first quarter, we actually saw relatively strong growth, partly because of the front loading before tariffs take place. But clearly, when we look at surveys, we see that firms, and again, it varies, so of course, across regions, but firms are delaying their investments. They are delaying their hiring plans. Consumers are much more cautious. They increase precautionary saving. And these are the important effects in the short run. Now, you asked about financial channels. Their volatility has gone up a lot, but as you mentioned, in response to some of the walking back of the measures, the big plunge in equity prices, for example, is now completely reversed. Similarly, higher credit spreads are now back to relatively benign levels. What has continued to change is the level of long-term interest rates. They have continued to increase, and also the effect on the dollar. So the dollar has weakened. But overall financial conditions have not tightened a lot, if you look at the combination. And of course, that's positive to some extent, but it also means that it can change very, very quickly. I mean, one of the things that we've seen, which we also highlight in the report, is that those firms that are likely to be more affected by the tariff increases, particularly in the manufacturing sector, have increased their credit lines quite a bit in response to these expected tariffs, which suggests that they're basically prepared for some shortages, for some increases in working capital, which may come from disruptive effects from tariffs. But it also shows that the financial system is still working and kind of is providing these credit lines.
Another potential problem that you highlight for the world economy is the change in the focus of financial intermediation has shifted from lending to private sector borrowers to sovereign debt. So who's holding the IOUs?
Pension funds and mutual funds are large holders, but so are insurance companies, hedge funds, central banks, and sovereign wealth funds, among others. Of course, the precise magnitudes depend on the specific market, and there are a lot of cross-border holdings. In particular, there has been a large increase in cross-border holdings over the past years among advanced economies. So we highlight in the report that the largest increase in holdings of US bonds of around 1.3 trillion over the last 8 years is accounted for by European investors. And the second largest increase of about 580 billion is due to investors from other advanced economies. So in both cases, there were also substantial bond flows in the opposite direction, that is, from the United States to Europe and other advanced economies.
And a lot of these are held by non-banks. This is something you spend a lot of time on the report. Does it matter if they're held by non-banks?
We argue that the shifts in financial activity toward NBFIs have increased the likelihood that financial instability could originate or be amplified by liquidity stresses.
Right.
And liquidity in sovereign bond markets increasingly relies on the types of NBFIs that I was mentioning, in particular, open-ended mutual funds, hedge funds, and other asset managers. These are different entities, but they often face significant liquidity mismatches. Some rely on short-term funding. Some are very, very leveraged, or at least exhibit leverage-like behavior. And as a result of that, the liquidity provision of these players is less stable and more likely to evaporate during periods of stress. And for example, particular hedge funds have become increasingly a source of pro-cyclical liquidity, particularly on government bond markets. But these hedge funds in some key markets, they have been pursuing trading strategies that seek to exploit the small price differences between related financial instruments, and they engage in heavy leverage when doing so. And that makes them vulnerable to adverse shocks in funding markets, in cash markets, in derivative markets. And we have seen some of that in recent episodes.
Put some numbers on the scale of non-bank activity now compared to how it was a couple of decades ago before the financial crisis.
The NBFI, non-bank financial intermediary sector, has grown considerably since the great financial crisis. According to data collected by the Financial Stability Board, the total financial assets of these NBFIs have grown from $87 trillion in 2006 to 239 trillion at the end of 2023, the latest data available. So they have grown considerably, and more so than banks.
The other type of financial instrument that's in the news at the moment is crypto. How much are you worried about crypto? How much is the financial system exposed to it? Is this a significant risk?
The financial system's exposure to crypto assets is still relatively limited, but it is growing.
Mm-hmm.
So the market capitalization of crypto assets is around $3 trillion, which is less than 1% of global financial system assets. And these assets are not yet widely used in financial services. But the interlinkages between the crypto ecosystem and the traditional financial system have grown significantly. And major financial institutions have begun integrating stablecoins into payment systems. They are considering issuing stablecoins, offering investment services for crypto assets. And I would highlight the development of stablecoins in particular. So that two stablecoins, Tether and Circle, which have reached a historically high market capitalization of about $240 billion. And so they are becoming big. They are becoming substantial holders of U.S. treasuries. And that's starting to raise concerns about potential spillovers into core markets. So in particular, these U.S. treasury markets, in especially during stress events. And recent research by our colleagues shows that outflows from stablecoins can have a significant impact on short-term interest rates. So the financial stability risks related to crypto assets are probably not yet very large. The rapid growth of this system and its integration with the traditional financial system, with the banks, could over time pose more significant risks if adequate regulatory oversight is not established. Of course, there are other concerns about stablecoins as well that are not directly related to financial stability. I mean, they raise concerns about monetary sovereignty, about illicit activity, the integrity of the monetary system. They don't really meet the requirements that money should have. You know, they don't offer elasticity, that is, they cannot provide it flexibly like regular money. So there are a number of other concerns that pertain to stablecoins.
Well, we've talked about sources of risk in the world economy so far. Your report also has many interesting things to say about how that risk is transmitted to the economy, particularly the speed with which it's transmitted. We'll talk about that in a moment.
The US is in a fiscal mess. That's what Giancarlo Gossetti and Riccardo Trezzi told us recently. For an analysis of the impact of ballooning debt and spiraling interest payments, catch up with this episode from September 2024.
Let's focus on the transmission mechanisms. You argue strongly in the report that there is now a much stronger cross-country transmission of financial conditions. Why do you make this argument?
It's mostly due to the larger presence of these internationally active asset managers in government bond markets, particularly that Gaston mentioned before. They tend to be much more internationally interconnected than traditional financial intermediaries. And so they're a conduit for transmitting financial conditions across countries. In the report, we have a very nice graph that illustrates the network of international portfolio flows. Their portfolios tend to adjust more rapidly to swings in risk attitudes and perceptions. Gaston already mentioned when the risk appetite is high, cross-border positions by global investors can build up quickly, but they can also unravel suddenly, leading to fire sales and sharp drops in asset prices in different markets. So this significant cross-border flows by asset managers boosts also this cross-country co-movements in financial markets. And in the report, as you mentioned, we show evidence that indeed financial conditions have become more correlated across countries. In dynamic factor analysis, we show that the variance in these financial conditions across countries explained by the two main factors, which is a level interest rate factor and a risk appetite factor, has increased by about 10 to 20 percentage points over the past decade or so. One of the other features of that analysis is that it's also variable, and particularly these correlations tend to rise in crisis times, which is something, of course, that is well known, that correlations increase when tensions increase.
And when we're talking about these flows, we're used to thinking about the transmission as being something that flows outward from the US economy, and there's such a lot going on in the US economy at the moment. Is this transmission still something that flows primarily from the US economy?
We do find that US still tends to transmit its financial conditions to other advanced economies more than the other way around. But on aggregate, the role of other advanced economies as transmission sources has been growing, both in terms of the level factor, which is monetary policy changes, when we think, for example, about ECB's monetary policy change and their effect, but also risk factors from Japan, from the euro area, may also translate more towards the US and more globally. And indeed, in the report, we document a significant negative correlation between portfolio bond inflows into the United States and US financial conditions, as, for example, measured by Goldman Sachs index. Having said this, we also, of course, look at to what extent that is an issue for the control of domestic financial conditions for domestic monetary authorities, and find that domestic monetary policy still has the dominant effect in most countries on domestic financial conditions. But particularly when it's about the risk appetite factor, that is really a common element. And of course, that's important to take into account for domestic monetary authorities.
Now, related to this, you highlight the role of the FX swap market. In your words, the linchpin of the international financial system. Now, for people who aren't familiar with it, can you explain that and why that matters so much?
The global nature of the activities of major NBFIs, these non-bank financial intermediaries, means that they have to really take currency risk into account in their investment decisions. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, pension funds and life insurers, they have obligations to their beneficiaries, policyholders, in domestic currency. But they often invest globally. They seek a diversified portfolio in several currencies. For them, hedging currency risk is key. And the system has evolved to facilitate such hedging. And these are the FX swaps in particular. In a way, one can say that these FX swaps make money fungible across currencies. This is an instrument that essentially is like a collateralized borrowing operation. For example, say you have a euro area pension fund who borrows US dollars to invest in dollar bonds while pledging euros as collateral, promising to unwind the transaction later on at the pre-agreed exchange rate. This has become very important. Interestingly, despite the fact that there is a full exchange of principal amounts at the end of the contract, The accounting convention means that this is not counted as debt, but as an off-balance sheet obligation. So it's not very visible, but it's huge. Yeah. The outstanding FX swap market, or the volume of outstanding FX swaps, has reached 111 trillion US dollars, with FX swaps counting for roughly 2/3 of that. And the largest and fastest growing segment has been precisely with NBFIs. And most swaps have the US dollar on one side that reflects the role of the US dollar in the global financial system. Therefore, we highlight this market and we argue that it has been a crucial factor in enabling the globalization of particular sovereign bond markets.
Once we're getting to the hundreds of trillions, then does this mean that central banks should really be keeping an eye on this hedging activity?
Yes. First, because the volumes of FX swaps are a good indicator of the hedging activities and thereby also of the international portfolio positions by bond investors in advanced economies. And they also serve as a key barometer of risk-taking and global financial conditions. So that's one reason why it's good to monitor them. But it's difficult to do so, right? Because many are traded over the counter. You have a range of participants. So it's difficult to track them and the concentrations and so forth. An important point is that there is typically a maturity mismatch involved. So higher hedge ratios, principle, can be a good thing, right? You protect yourself against currency risk. But you expose yourself to maturity risk because the maturity of the hedging instruments is typically shorter than that of the assets being hedged. So that means you have a rollover risk exposing hedged investors to stress in these dollar funding markets. And sometimes these markets don't work very well in times of stress. And that's why it's important to keep an eye on them.
Now, talking of barometers, I note that the BIS has introduced a financial conditions index. What is this? How do you calculate it?
This index tries to measure, as the name says, right, the financial conditions, the ease of borrowing, the appetite for risk, if you will, in the economy. The index developed by our colleagues is extracted from a set of 44 series covering short-term funding costs, the government bond yield curve, riskier bond yield spreads, equity market developments, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And from that large data set, the model extracts two factors that Frank was already alluding to. The first one is driven mainly by safe yields and reflects the average level of rates. The second factor is driven by spreads, equities, and risky yields, and therefore can be interpreted as a measure of risk attitude and risk perceptions. And then the two factors are combined in a way so as to maximize their ability in forecasting GDP growth. And it turns out that the risk factor receives a weight that is three times larger as that of the level factor. In other words, the risk attitudes, risk perceptions are a big driver, are very correlated with future GDP growth.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the policy solutions that you recommend to some of these problems that we're seeing in the global economy. I note that you are advocating pro-growth, structural reforms, and public investment. Why do you make this recommendation?
Well, the structural reform agenda is particularly the one that is needed to address the low economic and productivity growth that we have seen over decades now in most advanced economies, and that we're also seeing a slowdown in emerging markets economy more recently. No, neither expansionary fiscal nor monetary policies can address or can act as a lasting driver of long-term growth. Structural reforms have often been lagging behind, but we think the need to implement them now has become more pressing than ever for two main reasons. The first one is that there's a lot of structural change going on. I mean, we talked about the fragmentation of the global trading system and geopolitical risks that will lead to a reordering of the supply chain in the world economy. But we also have climate change and the energy provision that needs to be changed. And we also have digitalization. And so the economy needs to reallocate resources to different sectors because of this structural change. This can only happen without limited cost and sort of low inflation if the economy is flexible. And so structural reforms that make the economy markets less rigid, more flexible, are therefore important to facilitate this structural change, which is pervasive everywhere. I mean, structural reforms are very much complementary to some of the other policies that we would like to do or that are ongoing. First of all, in the report, we again highlight the fiscal vulnerabilities. Public debt ratios are still, on average, at peacetime record highs. Higher growth is sort of the best way of growing your way out of that. So that's very important. But it's also important for example, the public investment programs that are now advocated in a number of countries, like in Germany. If you want these to be successful, the supply side of the economy will have to respond favorably to these investment programs. If the economy is not flexible enough to respond, then there's a risk that rather than improving the economy and output, it just leads to higher inflation. So the structural reforms are, I think, very much in terms of like a two-handed approach, go together with public investment programs. And also for monetary policy, one of the issues we also raise in the report is that in this world of more supply shocks driven by these structural changes, the trade-offs for central banks may be more difficult because many of these supply shocks may lead to lower output and higher inflation. They create a conflict between stabilization of inflation and of output. Again, structural reforms and more flexible economies will reduce that trade-off and make monetary policy easier.
As you say, that governments have been talking about public investment. You get the case of Germany, but it is always very controversial, isn't it? It's always hard fought, and some governments are pulling back from public investment is what you're recommending now politically palatable, politically feasible?
Reform often impacts vested interests and therefore leads to resistance. It's often why it's better to do these type of programs and reforms when it's part of an overall policy package. And again, that's one of the reasons why in the report we highlight, you know, the complementarity of the various policies. It's also better to implement it in good times. And again, well, we'll see what the outlook says, but this time is as good as any other time. But the leeway also depends very much on the fiscal space. In countries like Germany, which does have a fiscal space, this will be much easier, particularly because there is quite a bit of public support, I think, to what the government wants to do. Of course, in others, the leeway may be less, and then the program will have to be adjusted.
Yes, in the report, you are recommending fiscal consolidation at the same time. And I was reading that and I thought, surely that's a contradiction, is it?
It will depend on the specific fiscal situation in the country. The situation is not the same across countries, but growth-friendly fiscal consolidation, we think, is inevitable in countries with large government debt. While these large debts were sustainable in an environment with relatively high growth and very low interest rates, these conditions have changed. We mentioned before that interest rates have increased, long-term interest bond yields have increased and are likely to stay higher than before. So for those countries, I don't think there's much of an alternative. I would argue two things in this context. I mean, first of all, what's important is to have a strong fiscal framework. A lot can be done also in terms of public acceptance. If you have a strong, credible, sustainable framework, that kind of allows you to do policies in a much more flexible and gradual way, which should be positive for the outcome. So reinforcing the credibility of the fiscal framework, as is done in some countries, I think is important because it actually helps the effectiveness of the program. And the second thing, and this comes back to your question, again, the quality of the fiscal adjustment is important, no? So there's many different ways in which you can consolidate. And there's quite a bit of evidence that there are sort of better ways of consolidating, for example, by not cutting investment spending, but focusing on other spending categories than other ways.
Now, moving on to regulation, the numbers that you've given me on the size of the non-bank financial intermediary sector and the growth are very surprising. You argue for consistent regulation of banks and non-banks. Where's the gap in the framework today? Who needs to act to close that gap?
Well, as mentioned, we observe rising liquidity risks, especially in government bond markets, and that deserves attention. As mentioned earlier, hedge funds often employ highly leveraged trading strategies, which are vulnerable to adverse shocks. And this vulnerability has risen further as financing terms have become increasingly lax, so they can really lever up quite a bit, which in turn means that even slight increases in haircuts can trigger forced selling and amplify financial stability. Mm-hmm. And we have seen such dynamics. For example, during the market turmoil of March 2020, these dynamics also contributed to the volatility spike in the treasury market in April. And the principle that we are advocating is that the same types of risks should be met with an equally stringent regulation. So similar financial risks, regardless of where they originate, should be subject to consistent regulatory standards, not necessarily the same regulatory measures, right? Because these are different entities. The types of measures are not likely to be the same, but it's important that we tackle the same type of risks with similar stringency. And non-bank financial intermediaries have so far often escaped that scrutiny that we apply to banks. And also, we need to strengthen the transparency requirements for these non-banks, making sure that the activities, including the leverage and off-balance sheet activities, are better understood and monitored.
You also call for more central bank coordination. What does this actually mean? Does this mean keeping in touch more, or does it go as far as something like joint rate setting?
It's more important than ever for central bankers to talk to each other. Regular sharing of information that can help central banks to anticipate better the international ramifications of their own decisions, the decisions of others, and calibrate their policies accordingly so as to minimize any unintended consequences. And so continued and increased central bank cooperation is vital for the monitoring, the oversight of global financial markets as well, given the growing influence of internationally active non-banks that I was just describing.
It has been almost two decades since the last systemic crisis, two decades already. Now, we are taught to expect one about every 20 years. With this report, are you sounding the alarm?
What we want to do is to bring to the public's attention some of the issues. There's a lot of leverage in key markets. There are associated vulnerabilities. There are maturity mismatches. And while markets have shown resilience to the last shocks, that should not mean that we can be complacent about these risks.
The Bank for International Settlements annual economic report was released on the 29th of June. If you want to download it, you will find it at bis.org.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Coming soon on Vox Talks Economics, we have just visited the Paris School of Economics CEPR Policy Forum 2025, where we've been discussing the future of work. We'll be bringing you interviews with expert researchers over the next few weeks, so follow us to get every episode and tell your friends about it as well.